first of all, I wanted to introduce myself. I'm Sefer Razavi. First of all, thank you all for coming in such great numbers here. As people organizing against Israeli settler colonialism, we wanted to acknowledge our position currently on the lands of the Kanien-Gahaga. In English, they are referred to as the Mohawk people. And we are gathered on the Teoteaga, which in English is Montreal. And I think it's very important to acknowledge this in any type of activism against settler colonialism, to acknowledge the fact that our presence here and the reason why we have this panel tonight is that we are part of this process of ongoing colonialism. And the Canadian state, I wanted to say, was founded on the genocide of the indigenous people of these lands, and the present legislation keeps that genocide ongoing. And I think that for us being settlers, immigrants, or descendants of those forcefully brought to this land, it is very important in our collective duty to educate ourselves and remind ourselves and inform ourselves that we are still part of this ongoing whitewashing of indigenous systems. So lastly, right before starting the panel, I'd just like to remind everyone that on February 22nd, so this upcoming Monday, McGill BDS Action Network is putting forward a motion to endorse BDS campaigns. So if any of you feel compelled by this panel tonight, please come see us and inform yourself if you want to mobilize, or just if you're undergraduates at McGill, please come February 22nd at 3 p.m. at the SMOOC General Center. Thank you. And just to present Stefan Christoph, sorry. He's the radio CKUT host of the show Free City Radio, so thank you.
I think that the sound is working properly now, it seems. Can everybody in the back hear? Yeah? Okay. It's really good to be here tonight and to just provide a short introduction to the importance of the discussion that's happening right now at McGill University around the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for freedom and liberation. This movement is now over 10 and a half years old, and it really has come from a grassroots effort, not located in one place, but really all around the world. And the panelists tonight, Zahia Al-Masri and Mustafa Hanawi, are two activists that have been holding it down on the grassroots level for a long time, since the BDS movement was announced to the world in July 2005. I would just note that the BDS movement emerged on the one-year anniversary of the decision of the International Court of Justice that condemned the Israeli apartheid wall as illegal vis-a-vis international law. So the thing I would say briefly in the form of introduction, when I mentioned holding it down at the grassroots level, what I mean by that is that without this grassroots work that has been so important to pushing the BDS movement around the world, we would not be where we are now. And I think it's really important to validate and understand the power that, whether it's student groups or community groups, hold in pushing forward difficult issues vis-a-vis the mainstream, but groups holding it down on a principled level and really responding to the voices of those who are oppressed in this equation, which are the Palestinians. Despite all the pressure, despite all the campaigning against BDS, activists have been working tirelessly throughout the world now for over 10 and a half years, And of course, it's really essential to highlight that BDS was a call that was launched by over 170 Palestinian grassroots organizations on the ground in Gaza and in the occupied West Bank. So I believe you're starting?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll just introduce briefly Mustafa, who's a longtime Palestine solidarity activist, who is also an organizer at the Immigrant Workers Center in Côte d'Neige in Montreal, is also a former member of the International Solidarity Movement, and was actually the coordinator of the International Solidarity Movement in Jenin, West Bank, for a period of time. Mustafa is also a founding member of Israeli Apartheid Week, which actually started in Toronto, and is also a member of Tadamun Collective. And so I'll pass it over to Mustafa, and again, you know, big props to BDS McGill for pushing for this campaign, and please give it up for Mustafa.
Thank you, Stefan, and thank you very much to McGill BDS Action Network for inviting me, and also just to echo what Stefan said, people should be really congratulated in terms of their efforts to actually to make this this motion on divestment and for BDS at McGill concrete. And I think it's taken a long time, but the fact that we're at this point at McGill University, I think, shows to the effectiveness of BDS as a tool for solidarity with the struggle for the liberation of Palestine. So I think McGill BDS should be absolutely congratulated for their efforts. And so I'm going to talk briefly, not so much about the issues or Israel as an apartheid state, but BDS as a tool, why it is such a critical tool for us to use in our context being here in Montreal, and also sort of even a more local context at McGill University, and why BDS is important, why students should be supporting the vote and the call for BDS, and why it's relevant to us here, and not just sort of a distant act or an empty measure of solidarity, but why it is truly important in the global struggle. So, BDS as a tool, as Stefan had mentioned, boycott, the campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Is now over 10 years old, but its beginnings are actually much more interesting, and its connections to the South African struggle are very clear. So the call for BDS that eventually came public by the 170 Palestinian organizations in 2005 was initiated in 2001 at a conference in Durban, South Africa, at an international conference against racism, xenophobia, and discrimination. And it was there that it was the South African delegation that wanted to highlight Zionism as a form of apartheid, as a form of discrimination and racial inequality that the international community has to uphold as a priority in terms of Israel's acceptance of international law and international rule, and that caused a stir of controversy, backlash, a boycott by Western governments in 2001 of the UNESCO conference on racism, xenophobia, and discrimination, and it was from there that South Africans themselves, those who actually lived the experience of apartheid, that began to lead the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and against Israeli apartheid. And why, and BDS was eventually, from there after the Second Intifada, when you had a popular uprising that was also had a massive solidarity movement across the world, demonstrations that took place, we had participated in forms of direct action in solidarity with Palestinian people resisting the occupation in the West Bank in 2002 and in 2003 because the international community was doing little, because governments like the Canadian government or the American government or the British government were doing very little to defend the rights of an occupied people, and that Israel was able to act with a great sense of impunity. Operation Defensive Shield in 2002 was the largest mobilization, one of the largest mobilizations of Israeli troops in the West Bank. Over 20,000 Israeli troops laid siege for an entire year on the city of Nablus. They had laid siege and completely destroyed Jenin refugee camp. Hundreds were killed in a very short period of time, and the response from the international community was very little, was almost non-existent. No resolution was passed at the UN Security Council, and in fact, what Israel had done, because they were able to do so with such great impunity, was to actually erect an apartheid wall throughout the West Bank, starting in 2003, quote-unquote defending itself from terror. This wall literally took apart the West Bank and took 40% of the West Bank, which is illegal, again, under international law. But there were, again, there was complete impunity for Israel to actually carry out its crimes against the Palestinian people. And during this time, of the Second Intifada, there was continued calls for peace negotiations. There's no partner for peace. We don't have someone to sit with at the table. Yet the obligation is not upon the Palestinians. The obligation is upon Israel as an occupying state to uphold international law, and that Palestinians are very much in their right to resist by any means that they do so to defend themselves against the military occupation. And so it's clear that international law was not being applied in terms of the Palestinians. So the call for international solidarity and what can be done concretely became much more urgent, because what Israel was doing was not a simple act of responding to what was taking place in the West Bank. What they were doing was carrying out a plan that was much developed much long ago, because Israel has no interest in a two-state solution, and Netanyahu has made that clear. But Netanyahu is not the first person to make that clear, that Israel is not interested in a two-state solution. If you actually look at the map of the apartheid wall, it mimics a plan called the Yalom Plan. And the Yalom Plan actually was the one that carved up the West Bank into three Bantustans, completely separated from each other, that could not be a coherent landmass in terms of that would be able to create a sort of a sustainable Palestinian state within the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Palestinians, and this is what's important about BDS, is that it doesn't treat what Israel is doing as simply a question of two equal peoples or two competing narratives, but the question of boycott, divestment, and sanctions being inspired by the narrative of South Africa is to highlight that Israel is an apartheid state, and that Israel has always been an apartheid state, that there have been two laws for two sets of people, and that the aim of the Israeli state has always been that a minority of settlers will have the greatest control over land of the indigenous Palestinian people. And I'm not going to talk about those issues so greatly, but if you look at the law of return and the right of return, Palestinians do not have that same right. If you look at, in terms of the occupation, Israeli citizens within the West Bank have more access to water, are prosecuted under Israeli civilian law, while Palestinians are prosecuted under Israeli military law. and that Palestinians inside 48 face a great deal of discrimination. And this is what the call of BDS was founded on, that fundamental principles of universal justice, that Palestinians should have the same rights that Israeli citizens are able to have, or not even just Israeli citizens, any Jew around the world that can claim the law of return, Palestinians should be able to claim the same. And so it's not founded upon competing narratives, but an idea of universal justice. And I think that explosion, when that call was made in 2005, was able to sort of to begin to see the question of Palestine very differently. And the other important aspect of the BDS movement is that it defied Israeli exceptionalism. And one of the things that we saw after the launching of the BDS movement in 2005 is that why are people so focused on the question of Israel? Why aren't they talking about apartheid in Darfur? Why aren't they talking about what takes place in Saudi Arabia? Why aren't they talking about a number of countries around the world? But all of those countries aren't immune to international law. The Israel exceptionalizes itself because it doesn't want to adhere itself to international law. It itself doesn't want to adhere to Resolution 242 to call for an end to the occupation. It itself doesn't want to adhere to Resolution 194. Israel has exceptionalized itself. And Israeli apartheid has exceptionalized itself. So the fact that BDS has highlighted that exceptionalism, that, and if international law won't be applied from states, then people in a grassroots movement around the world have a major role to play in solidarity with Palestinian people to ensure that their rights are upheld. And I think the other critical aspect of that, in terms of what we saw in the BDS movement, is that the Israeli state has continued to delegitimize itself. That what we have seen since 2005 is a countless massacre after countless massacre, particularly in the Gaza Strip. We have seen nothing but a complete continual siege, which is completely illegal, which has forced 1.8 million Palestinians, in which 75% of them are refugees from only kilometers away from their homeland, from where they come from, have been forced to live a brutal siege without access to medicine, without access to reconstruction materials, without access to the freedom of movement, without access to their waters. And what we've seen is nothing but an escalation from Israel, because the people of Gaza refuse an occupation, because they refuse to not let go of the right of return and what's just to them. And so Israel's response has only become more and more dramatic. And the call for BDS from people in the Gaza Strip, from the Islamic University of Gaza, from the PGFTU, the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Union, which saw its offices bombed, from the university that was also bombed by the Israeli Air Forces. So the fact is that this call is not just coming from the outside, it's not coming from activists, but it's coming from Palestinians themselves. And they're demanding our solidarity in this way. And that's what's also critical about BDS. And we saw that call again being increased just recently with the beginnings of a new popular struggle in the occupied territories, where Palestinian youth have taken to the streets in an act of desperation, where we're beginning to see a very clear and calculated plan by the Israeli state to actually, for once and for all, annex completely the West Bank and truly show that there is no two states, that there is only one state, that all Palestinians are governed in some way by the Israeli state. We're seeing that in East Jerusalem. We're seeing that in Area C. So if people don't know, the West Bank is carved up into three areas. After the Oslo process in 1993, Area C, the West Bank has Area A, which is governed by the Palestinian Authority, which is a very small part of the West Bank. It only is actually the three major cities within the West Bank. Area B, which is under Israeli security control, and then Area C, which is supposed to be joint Palestinian-Israeli controlled, and it's very clear that Israel's annexing the majority of the territories under Area C. But regardless, and what we're seeing as a result of this popular resistance has been taking place since this summer, is a massive repressive assault by the Israeli security forces against popular resistance, not against armed groups. In Be'er Zeit University, in a building much like this, actually in the student union offices, the Israeli military raided and completely destroyed the offices of the student union, arresting student activists, detaining them without trial, detaining them under military law for arbitrary reason, because what they fear is another wave of popular resistance. What they fear is that people themselves are no longer going to cave into the leadership of the Palestinian Authority and that they're going to resist the occupation. So does BDS work? Is BDS a meaningful tool? It's a meaningful tool not only because it highlights Israel as an apartheid state in the same way that the BDS movement did around South African apartheid, which was a clear act of solidarity and did help for the liberation of black South Africans against minority white rule, but BDS is working now. In the 10 years, Palestinian activists and one of the co-founders of the BDS movement, Omar Barghouti, has called that this is finally Palestine-South African moment. That we've reached that watershed where BDS is beginning to have an impact. Just recently, the American Anthropological Association, 88% in favor of academic boycott. The Israeli media has just highlighted that almost $30 million in agricultural sales have dropped because of BDS. Foreign direct investment in Israel has dropped in 2014. We've seen countless trade unions, student unions here in Montreal, the Concordia Student Union, the Graduate Student Union, McMaster, also the University of Toronto and York University all adopt resolutions for divestment against those corporations that are complicit in the violations of international law against the Palestinian people. And in the Canadian context, the movement for BDS is critical. Many people say, well, this isn't the United States. We don't play the same role as the United States does in terms of the Israeli occupation. Quite on the contrary, we play a crucial role. We were the first government to actually to put a siege on Gaza. It wasn't the Americans, it wasn't the European Union, it was actually the Canadian government that defunded the Palestinian Authority of its funds from the Canadian government in Gaza Strip, because how dare they democratically elect their own government, even though that's what they called for, to get the funding initially. We have a Canadian-Israeli free trade agreement worth over $1.5 billion annually in trade. We have research, the Canada-Israeli Research Fund, which promotes normalization and bilateral research and development. We have direct support towards the Israeli military. If you look at corporations like CAE that operate and fly drones for the Israeli army, the same drones that are used over Gaza. So it's clear that the Canadian context is really critical. And if Canada, quote unquote, is now trying to play again, being an honest broker in the Middle East, then that means standing in complete justice for the Palestinian people. And I just want to quickly end on McGill's context. The student movement has always been vital to any solidarity movement around the world. And I think always there's going to be victories and there's going to be defeats. But if one looks back at McGill's own history during the struggle in solidarity with the South African apartheid movement, there was complete resistance to divestment from South African apartheid. McGill only divested in 1985, in April 1985. And you even have professors demanding, in response, investment in South African apartheid. And that's something that people have to remember, that the support, we look now back on history, lots of people think, no, how could anybody support South African apartheid? One of the ugliest forms of a racial colonial state. How could have anyone supported it? There was complete mainstream support for it. It was a liberal democracy in a sea of barbarism in Africa. And it's the same logic that many people who support Israeli apartheid use today. And it was actually when students, for 5 years, launched a divestment campaign, up until the point that McGill students actually swarmed the Board of Governors meeting at McGill University, that they won a divestment campaign at McGill, and that they were able to expose those ties to South African apartheid. And it's those stories that we should learn from when we're thinking about BDS and how do we apply the strategy of boycott, divestment, and sanctions here, and how we can best expose those ties at McGill University, whether it be Technion, whether it be corporations that are complicit in the occupation, whether it be ending normalization with Israeli academic institutions. And maybe we can discuss the academic boycott in the discussion period, but McGill did create a successful divestment movement before, and it can create one again. And its role, even though maybe one institution out of hundreds or thousands of universities across the world, it is a voice that is desperately needed, especially when students in Verzeit are being crushed, when universities in Gaza are being bombed. It is a meaningful act of solidarity at this moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mustafa Kanelli. We will now have a presentation from Zahia El-Masri, who's a Palestinian activist here in Montreal, originally from Borj el-Barashni refugee camp in Beirut, Lebanon, and before that, originally from Palestine, of course. Right now, Zahia is working with ROMEL, which is the Regroupement des Organismes Montréal Ethniques pour le Logement, so the regroupment of Montreal organizations in support of housing. And Zahia has, for a long time, really done a lot of work to try to link the Palestinian struggle for justice with local struggles, and seeing the direct connection between struggles in our own society for equality, for economic justice, for justice around workplace, around housing rights, with the Palestinian struggle. So it's really great to introduce Zahia, and please put your hands together.
Thank you, Stefan, and thank you very much. very much for the invitation tonight. And honestly, chapeau and congratulations for taking this initiative. It's actions like these that truly do count. As Stefan mentioned, I was born as a Palestinian refugee in Lebanon. And even though I was born in Lebanon, as some of you may know, I still do get a card, basically, and c'est passé, from the United Nations Refugee Agency saying that I was born as a refugee in Lebanon. To my parents' surprise, they were thinking that since we were born in Lebanon, we'd actually get a document that would at least give us some rights, but that wasn't the case. And to have this form of document with you throughout your life leaves quite an impression. It goes beyond a symbolic impression. It's something that you carry with you every day. And this continued when we moved here to Canada, we moved to Montreal, and everybody was questioning, from Palestine, what is that? Is that in Africa? Okay. And then on my dad's immigration documents, believe it or not, it was written that he was a pirate. Because my dad was born in Haifa. And when Haifa was still Palestine. And for them, they didn't recognize the state of Palestine, they didn't recognize Palestine, and therefore they didn't recognize Haifa. And when we insisted, we said, we even have his birth certificate. On his birth certificate, it says Haifa, Palestine. Yet they insisted on having the word pirate on his document. And until today, my dad is labeled as a pirate on his immigration document in Canada. So you can imagine as these things kind of follow you around. So when I started going here, I went to Vanya as a CJEP. And when we started becoming more and more involved with the Palestinian Student Union, which was also HBHR at the time, the first reaction that we got whenever we had exhibitions or whenever we were talking about Palestine was members of Hillel coming across and wearing the Israeli flag and just telling us, you don't even exist. That was the initial encounter that we had. And this for me was quite a shock because having grown up in Lebanon and lived through the Israeli invasion in 1982 and the Sabra and Shatila massacre, to see this and see the same hatred being reenacted here was quite a shock. This was not something that I had expected to see here. And this carried out also throughout my years at Concordia, so on and so forth. And even McGill, in the same building, we held hunger strikes during the time, I forgot the year, for the 400 deportees, when Palestinian prisoners were sent to no man's land. So we held hunger strikes even here at McGill. This is all just to highlight the importance of actions like these and involvement of students, just in terms of raising awareness and what it means to be Palestinian. What it means to be Palestinian today is to be negated the right of your identity, is to be negated the right of return, is to be even negated the right to have the collective imaginary of a Palestinianhood. That is even being put in question. Your entire identity is always being put in question. The first thing that is thrown at you is, well, you don't really even exist. Did Palestine really ever exist? This is the strength also of the BDS movement and what it did. Because it's a grassroots movement, it came and it gave a different framework for the Palestinian narrative. Now Palestinian students and Palestinian and those who support the Palestinian cause came with the BDS tool and said, you know what? This is what we claim. We're following the tradition of Mahatma Gandhi. We're following the tradition of Martin Luther King. And when Mustafa spoke about South Africa, this is the tradition that we are following with. Can you question these legitimate concerns? Can you question these? Are you going to question the path that Martin Luther King led? Are you going to question what Gandhi did? And this falls into the same category. The strength, again, of the BDS movement, and especially the right of return, is that it's a question that's at the heart of the Palestinian identity. And then when we speak of everything the Palestinians are going through, whether it's inside Israel, whether it's inside the West Bank, whether it's in Gaza, they're living the same kind of settler colonialism, of oppression. You have the checkpoints that can be opened and closed at any time. When I was in Palestine, I visited in 2004, and I saw the students at Bir Zeit University, I was impressed. I mean, here I remember going to class, and if the professor didn't show up, I don't know if you have the same policy at McGill, but after 50 minutes, if they don't show up, the class is canceled. And we'd be like, yeah, class is canceled, great, especially if you had an exam or something. Well, at Bir Zeit University, in spite of the checkpoints, in spite of the fact that there's a policy, even if there's closure, okay, and you have an exam, if you don't show up to the exam, that's your problem. The exam will still go through. And I saw students crossing roads that you would say, I mean, is it really worth it, putting their lives in danger just so they can get to their university, just they can have access to a decent education? This is knowing fully well that even after having access to, quote unquote, a decent education under the circumstances, their prospects of finding decent employment, of finding decent housing, of having a decent future are little to none. Yet they still pursue and they still persevere in order to have access to this education. And this is also what distinguishes the Palestinian cause, is this perseverance. For decades now, what Palestinians have been going through, the injustice that is being basically lived on a daily basis by every Palestinian, whether in diaspora or on the inside. And when I speak of the inside, I also include Palestinians living under Israel, because their plight is also being fought on a couple of fronts. They have their identity as Palestinians living under the direct rule of their occupier, yet they've managed to thrive in some cases. They have managed to create IT companies which hire a majority of Palestinians still living under Israeli rule. And as you know, Palestinian citizens, as also actually Ethiopian Jews, are treated as second-class citizens within Israel, okay? And yet, in spite of all the pressures that they live under, they have managed to find ways to thrive. This applies in the same scenario as Palestinians living in the West Bank and even in Gaza. I have my cousin who's living in Gaza. His house has been destroyed. Actually, I lost count how many times the house has been destroyed. Yet still, when we speak with him, just a couple of months ago, his wife posted they went for the olive harvest. And she went and she took her mom for the olive harvest. In order to be able to harvest the olives, it's a huge and very, very, very tiring process. And it takes hundreds of years to harvest olives. Yet Palestinians, even in Gaza, they still go through with it and they still find the hope and the strength to go and to go through with it and then to talk about it and then to complain even about it because it was either too hot or it was even not all family members show up. Yet still they go through with it. And that hope is at the heart of the strength of the Palestinian cause. Because after all, they have justice. We have justice on our side. When we speak about the right of return, the law of return, now 194, it's decreed by the United Nations. Nobody can come and question that right. And everything that the Palestinians ask for is for the international law to be applied. During my last visit there, I went, and this is a story that I often tell because it's something that really speaks to me. I had my son with me, and we were at a demonstration for prisoners' rights. And I had my son, and there were moms, and they had posters, several posters of their sons being in prison. In Israel, you have administrative detention. When you go into administrative detention, you don't know what you're being detained for. You don't know when you're going to be released. Your family doesn't know either. And also in Israel, you could get a couple of sentences, lifetime sentences, all right? And in those lifetime sentences, it's really something that's up to Israel to let you visit your prisoners, know when they're going to be released, have access to them, and sometimes you have zero access to them. So I saw these moms, and they had posters of their kids and so on and so forth. And I couldn't help myself, and I had my son with me, and I just held him close to me, and I started crying. And this woman came up to me. She said, I thought she was going to comfort me. And she said, why are you crying? And I said, well, I can't help but seeing. I mean, especially since my aunt was kidnapped in 1982 in Lebanon by the Israeli military. And until today, we don't know what happened to her. We have no news, okay? So I can relate to what it feels like to not know. You know, if she's dead, at least we know that she's dead. We'd go and visit her and bury her and do what's proper, you know? But we just don't know. So that feeling of not knowing, of not being able to commemorate those that were lost, you know, it takes away. it takes away from a person and makes you feel like you don't have control. So she said, no, this is not a place to cry. What we're asked, what we are asking for, is rightfully ours. The only thing we're asking, we're not asking right now for the release of our prisoners. We are asking to have access to them. We are asking what international rights gives us as our right. This is what we are asking for. And this is what Palestinians have done for decades. And what the BDS movement came and strengthened even more is that we are asking what is rightfully ours. No more, no less. And until there's recognition of the Nakba of 1948, there's recognition of the Deir Yassin massacre, there's recognition of Kfar Qasim massacre, there's recognition of what's happening in Gaza, there's recognition of everything that's happening in the West Bank, there's recognition of the Palestinian diaspora, there's recognition of what Palestinian refugees are living in camps. You have camps in Syria, camps in Lebanon, and with the Syrian refugee crisis being brought into the media, just know that a lot of those refugees in Syria, they're not at their first refugee crisis. This is not the first time that they have been basically relocated or their rights taken away or being taken to another yet refugee camp. This has all to be taken in consideration. And every action that is taken here, whether it's at McGill or Concordia or any student body, is significant. Just the fact that you speak with another student and you raise awareness about what's happening, about the injustices that Palestinians live through on a daily basis, because sometimes these injustices are forgotten. And the media, unfortunately, doesn't speak out about them. Now we're talking about peace initiatives. What peace initiative? The reality on the ground doesn't allow for true peace initiative or for true peace to be accomplished. Mustafa mentioned, there's no way that right now we can have a viable Palestinian state, especially with what's happening with the continuation of the settlements. This is still ongoing. We talk about peace, but the reality on the ground has nothing to do with peace. So just by raising awareness, by going, I believe it's next Monday that you have a General Assembly here where you're going to speak out. This is important. Every move that you make, every action, every time you spread the word about what's going on, don't underestimate it. It makes a huge difference. I just want to close a bit by just mentioning the importance of the right of return that goes beyond the recognition, that goes beyond symbolism. I know that this is something that we live here. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to speak to a group of Native Indians regarding their access to decent and social housing. And this is something also that we don't hear about often. So that's why it's important that the reason I mentioned Natives is that it should go beyond symbolism. It should be concrete actions. This is also what BDS translates into, concrete actions. You support the Palestinian cause, you recognize the injustices committed, then automatically you support BDS. Thank you.
Thank you to Zahia Al-Masri and also to Mustafa Hanawi for their presentations. We'll have a brief opportunity to take a few questions from the audience. Before that, I just want to highlight two points regarding CK2 Radio, which is the campus community radio association that is connected with McGill University. CKUT has actually endorsed BDS, and CKUT Radio took a resolution to AMARC, which is the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, and brought it to the international meeting of AMARC in Argentina. And the BDS resolution was actually passed by the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, which was a really important gesture. And I think really highlights a quick point that I wanted to link around objectivity, because I think within the academic context, a lot of people will sort of critique a movement like BDS only listening to, say, the Palestinian perspective and try to present this notion of balance and objectivity, right? Within the context of a struggle for justice, you know, as student activists or as people involved in community radio, the idea that I wanted to put out there briefly is that we listen to the voices of the oppressed. And that's really what BDS is about at its roots, is listening, as was mentioned by both Mustafa and Zahia, to Palestinian voices who are calling for justice and who are specifically calling for a global boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. And I just want to underline that point, very, very important point, which I think is that as a solidarity movement, we are listening to what Palestinians on the ground are demanding, which is BDS. And we responded at CKUT Radio, which was not easy. It was quite a long debate, and it was also quite a long debate within the context of the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, right? So I think that we really had a lot of discussions about that within the CKUT context, because we are a community station that prioritizes voices of marginalized people. So for us, we really sort of have a critique towards this notion of objectivity in journalism. But I think within the academic context also, I think it's important to think critically about the ways that that argument of objectivity will try to silence the perspective and the voices of the oppressed. So we have a bit of time for questions. Please, in your questions, we have probably, I think, about 20, 30 minutes or so. Yeah, so please keep them respectful, and I'll open the floor.
I mean, one simple answer is to look at actually South Africa, right? And one very simple answer was, I mean, again, this was the same argument then, is that if we end apartheid, black South Africans will drive us into the sea. We will no longer exist. If we have a one nation, one vote, one person, one vote, one state, the slogan was, right? And if we had that full equality, South Africa would just implode. And actually, South Africa didn't implode. So it's very clear by ending apartheid, Israeli apartheid, that in terms of negatively affect Israeli citizens, I think is wrong. I think what Palestinians are demanding is simply justice. I think the status, and the other argument is that also it's the status quo that actually hurts Israeli citizens at this moment. It's the fact that they're seen as supporting an occupation. It's the fact that they have to live under, the fact that they have to serve, you know, that it's mandatory for all Israelis to serve under the military, the fact that their state is imploding, the fact all of these things is a result of an ongoing colonial project impacts them negatively, right? And I think, the argument that, you know, all of a sudden, if there's justice, that, you know, and that there was full equality and the right of return at the end of the occupation, that this would negatively impact Israeli citizens, I think, is false. And also, I'll leave it at that.
It's also just seeing the other side also of the medallion. Is the status quo, like Mustafa mentioned, is the status quo better? The status quo is not better. Supporting institutionalized discrimination is not better. Not supporting international law is not better. And you have to know also that not all Israelis, it's a very, not all Israelis support what the Israeli government is doing right now. There's actually an increase of right Zionist soldiers who are being enrolled in the military army. There's an increase of quite a number, I forgot the number of percentage, but it's almost more than 10% And this has increased over the years. So imagine if at the end we have Netanyahu today, and with an increase of the even more ultra-right Zionism, what kind of an Israeli state do you have? And what kind of system are you going to have on the ground? So by supporting BDS, you're only basically supporting international law. We should just see one positive note, that Israel has been the role of Israel. It went from Canada's best friend to a good ally. So that's good. At least, Stéphane Dion, you know, said it, so we have to recognize that. However, regarding BDS, I realize that the position of Justin Trudeau was what you had just mentioned. And that's why it's important that every institution, there is a push forward. The work happens within universities. This is where the work happens. And the importance is why this is a place for debate. This is a place where academics, where students have all the freedom they need to debate, to exchange ideas, and to vote on how, what kind of institution they want to be in and where they want to see their institutions going. So it is actually, and Mustafa, I'm sure you can add to this, it's very crucial that universities and all academic institutions continue. And Mustafa mentioned, he highlighted a couple of the wins of the BDS campaign. This doesn't happen easily, and it doesn't occur easily. And in spite of what he spoke, the importance of going to your elected officials and telling them, you know, this is what we would like, this is what we want you to hear. Don't underestimate your elected officials. If 10 of you go tomorrow, whichever riding that you live in, and you tell them, this is what we want to talk about, they have to listen to 10 of you. If only one person goes, and if they go, you know, every now and then, well, it won't be such strong advocacy. But again, if 10 of you go, if 20 of you go, and they speak of the BDS movement, and they say that this is something that we think is legitimate, even if it's not something that they wanna, you know, advocate for, at least have a place to hear the BDS plan play out, and to be able to vote, and to be able to say why you support and why you don't support.
I mean, I think it's a good thing Justin Trudeau made those comments, right? Because it shows the impact. If he wants to give the BDS movement more media, that's great. Because unfortunately, the other side, which you now, people go back and forth in terms of using to sort of discredit the BDS movement, and even the use on the international stage to actually discredit the Palestinian cause is always dialogue. It's always the question of BDS is too much, how about we just have dialogue? And if people, you know, shake hands, salam, shalom, everything would be wonderful. And that eradicates the entire problem, that this is a problem of an oppressed people versus an occupying state. It's not a dialogue of two equals. And the same, you know, and that translates to the way those delegitimizing tactics are used sort of on campuses. Israeli academic Ilan Pape, I heard him say this once, that you're simply just a bad academic if you actually don't support BDS, and you're a bad social scientist and have no understanding of history. So I think, I mean, of course, BDS is going to be discredited by Trudeau, by the government of the day, until they see it as being really popular, until they really see it as something that that would cost them votes. Until that moment really comes, I think that they're always going to end up supporting Israeli apartheid for their own electoral reasons, but also in terms of the role that Israel plays within the region is also critical. So it makes our activism even more important.
So we have time for a few more questions. Is there any others? Sure. This is your one opportunity for questioning Mustafa and Zahir. I try to have gender parity, so is there any... go ahead.
This will a movement that affects all Israelis will actually perpetuate a myth that's, I think, being used to manipulate the population that the BDS movement is far more malicious than I think it actually is, in the sense that I think there are a lot of people, I'm sure you've heard these arguments used against the BDS movement, that there are intentions to delegitimize Israel's status. I can see an argument, I can understand an argument that this will actually alienate people that stand in solidarity with Palestinians. And I was wondering what you think of that.
So I've been asked to repeat the question briefly for the live streaming audience. Basically, if I can summarize, the question was, a request to respond to the critique that the BDS movement is a blanket approach to dealing with critiques towards Israel, and that it could potentially delegitimize calls for justice, human rights for the Palestinians, and alienate some Israelis who are sympathetic towards Palestinian human rights. Are these questions important to consider? What do you think of these questions, if that's a summary?
Even before the BDS movement, Israel's practices, unjust practices, and non-respect of international law existed, and it hasn't ceased to exist. So the BDS in and of itself is not a reflection of, or a way of saying, this is what's gonna stop Israel's unjust, basically, occupation, or settler colonialism, or the illegal wall, or any of its unjust occupation or actions towards Palestinians. BDS, like Mustafa mentioned, is a tool. So if those Israelis, if this has any reflection on those Israelis that you're saying, because a lot of them, they do sympathize with the Palestinian cause, then even more reason to join the BDS movement and say, we are against these illegal actions. Because you should never lose sight that this is in reaction to injustices being committed against the Palestinian people. The BDS movement didn't just appear in order to react to a non-existent threat. It appeared in order to address the issue, which is the non-recognition of Israel of the right of return for Palestinians, which is the settler colonialism, which is the discriminating policies against Palestinians, which is the Israeli occupation. This is what the BDS movement is replying to. So those who do sympathize and those who do think it's going to have a negative effect should just question Israel's actions instead of questioning the big victim's way of reacting and of defending themselves and for asking what is rightfully theirs.
In terms of the critiques, and I don't have much to add to what Zahir had said, but I mean, I think that when one thinks about that, regardless of, I mean, you have people boycott from within, you have academics like Ilan Pape who says, boycott me. You should boycott me. You have that voice, and also the fact that is that in, I forget which Israeli operation in Gaza, where there was almost, not Operation Cast Lead, but the one after, where you actually had defense, where you had 90% support of a massacre on the people of Gaza. 90% support. So in terms of a negative effect, it's apartheid that's having a negative effect, and that's isolating Israelis in terms of within the international community. It's not the calls for justice. It is apartheid that is creating that isolating effect. And I think that to me is the biggest response maybe to that criticism.
So we actually only have time for one more question. Maybe you can each ask your question quickly. Yes. So I'll just repeat very briefly. The first question was about BDS being presented as a confrontation with the Israeli state and Israel, as opposed to another approach. I'm trying to summarize. I think I'll let the panelists, Zahia and Mustafa, respond. I actually didn't really understand your question, but I hope that you did. I think it was about do you want to read?
As in, from your personal experience in Palestine, do you think it's very relevant to people there and their daily oppression?
Okay.
The way it's integrated.
Okay, so is BDS relevant to people on the ground in occupied Palestine?
Yeah,
so it's a question. People facing the daily repression. So this will be the last round of questions, so if you could keep your responses focused, that'd be really great. Thank you.
Maybe I'll try to answer, the question of reaction or confrontation. BDS, a very long history of BDS, and a very quickly. The first call for BDS was in 1929 in Haifa, actually, against sort of the colonial project, the Zionist colonial project that actually had begun in the late 1800s, right? So there was an attempt to try to have a liberation movement well before, and a nonviolent one, actually. The longest general strike in modern history was of Palestinians in 1936 against British colonial rule. And again, Zionist colonialism. And what we've seen is that from the history from 1947 up into this day, what is left of the land and people's equal right and access to that land is at its last stage. So is it a reaction? Yes, in a way it is, to try to find a new tool that people can use democratically, non-violently, in many different ways that they can, to express their solidarity, and an effective tool. But it is a way of being able to sort of, it is a reaction, but it's also one that is about innate justice. So it's not a confrontation, you did this and I did that. It's about that there is no exceptionalism, and that we will all live in the same land with the same rights and the same obligations for all people.
I'm going to try to bridge the two questions, because I think they're related in a way. I'll start with this, with your question. Palestinians in the West Bank and in Jerusalem have been organizing in order to buy local, okay, for decades now. They actually have campaigns. And right now, there's a grassroots campaign that was started among Palestinian children from their primaire and secondaire in order to talk to them about the pride of buying local. Okay? Palestinian women have been organizing also from the outset in groups, in women's groups, also to produce local and to buy local, because it inspires pride. Okay? And it gives local Palestinians more work, more employment. And again, we go back to the issue of pride. And yes, it's a form of resistance. It's a form of saying, we are Palestinians, this is our identity, and we will buy local. So when BDS comes into play, like Mustafa mentioned, it's not, I mean, it is a reaction. It is a reaction to everything that's happening on the ground. It's a change of narrative for Palestinians, because we're saying right now, this is what has been going on, these are the injustices committed, and this is our answer. This is our non-violent way of requesting that the international community acts towards Israel's position and the way that Israel considers itself impunitive, and the way how international law doesn't apply to Israel. This is how BDS can be used as a tool. So in a way, it just brings all the legitimate concerns of the Palestinians and presents them in a framework where it says, this is what we're requesting, and this is what we're going to give you to make these requests.
So we're running out of time, we'll have one more announcement, and I'll just highlight two points briefly. I just want to acknowledge and thank again Zahi El-Masri, a longtime Palestinian community activist here in Montreal, and Mustafa Hanawi, a longtime Egyptian-Canadian activist between Toronto and Montreal, and it's been really great to hear their perspectives, and also Big ups to McGill BDS for all your work. I just wanted to acknowledge two quick points. The first is that this notion and this push towards BDS in Montreal really takes place within a big context. And I just wanted to give one other Montreal-specific example that's very, very inspiring, and it's something a lot of us worked on for a long time. In Montreal, in 2010, 500 artists only from this city signed an open letter in support of BDS. And so that was artists from, you know, many celebrated groups, hip-hop artists, theater artists, members of Godspeed You Black Emperor, members of the Arcade Fire, dancers with Mélie Chouinard, like tons of artists signed this letter. And I just want to acknowledge this to say that this upcoming vote next week at McGill, and of course, Mustafa mentioned the motions at Concordia with the Graduate Student Association, also with the Undergraduate Student Association, the CSU last year. So your upcoming vote at McGill takes place in a large context of a lot of big efforts that have been made by grassroots activists, student activists, community activists. And so when you're mobilizing and putting forward the energy for your vote, I just want to highlight the fact that there's a long continuum of work, and your efforts are part of, obviously, a big local effort. And also just to highlight that, of course, it's in response to this last question, BDS was called for from occupied Palestine. So it was Palestinian activists who initiated it, and it's very much a response to that. So thanks again to Mustafa and Zahia, and to SPHR McGill and the BDS group. And also we have these posters, if you'd like any. They're called Imaging Apartheid. So,
thank you so much to the speakers. Honestly, give them a round of applause. So we a big part of why we're doing this event series is to raise awareness about BDS and also to have people come out to the GA on Monday. It's very important that we get a big turnout because the opposition is mobilizing very strongly and the tactics they have been using have been very lowbrow. So we'd like to counter that with very good competition and with bodies in the room, basically. So please, if you forget, the GA is Monday at 3 p.m. in SMU and the main room is going to be the ballroom, so behind you. And if the ballroom gets at capacity, they might not let people in. So it's very important people come around 2:30 or early enough so everyone can be let into the room so we can occupy as much space as possible. Also, if you want to learn more about BDS, we have a rabbi, Michael Davis, coming in tomorrow at 6 p.m. It's going to be in McConnell 204. He's going to make a moral case for BDS, and he's going to talk about why BDS isn't anti-Semitic.